Accession number 18474, Reel 3.
John Dyer, Reel 3.
Yes, it was scary. I mean, you can't admit it, but it was scary at the time. At the time, it was, yes, you didn't really know what was going to happen to you. It was a matter of survival. It was all right when we were sort of firing from a distance. But when it got to close combat, that was when it really sort of, hey, what's going on here? You know, it's this guy against me. You know, I don't really want to, you know, sort of dispose of him. I don't want to, I suppose the word is kill him. I mean, I don't want to take his life. But if he's prepared to take mine, I've got, you know, nobody wants to die. So it's a matter of defend yourself. So I'm afraid that is what had to happen for quite some time, and it was really scary at the time. Yes, it was, you know, it's not until afterwards and you start to think, hey, crikey, you know, this is what went on there, and you get back and you start talking to your mates, and you know, you realise then that, I don't suppose luck comes into it, and yeah, I suppose it do. You were fortunate enough to come through it, and then it hits you. And I'm afraid then the nerve starts to go. Or it affected me that way, shall we put it that way. I know it affected a lot of others the same way, but speaking personally, the nerve started to go. What happens? Well, you have to take too, perhaps drop too much drink. You live the day. Perhaps you smoke too much. Perhaps you think, well, live today and hope that you make the next one. It's a very, very difficult thing to explain. But yes, you are scared. Of course you're scared. Anybody would be, if, you know, lose your lead and bullets and shrapnel and mortars going off. And of course you're scared. It's something that's foreign to you, isn't it? It's not a thing that you can expect. Yes, and you... And then when it's all over, you blase it off, and it's not until years on, and you think about these things that yes, you realise how lucky you are.
Were you in hand-to-hand fighting with the Chinese?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Oh, what form did that take?
Oh, rifle butts, bayonets, fists, feet, a good clout with a boot between the legs works wonders. It might sound a bit savage now, but well, I suppose it was savage, really.
Were you in trenches when they reached you?
No. They were all abandoned. We were in open country. So
was this when you were retreating?
Yeah. It's when we were pulling out. Actually, we even when we were in fixed lines, there wasn't a great deal. It's very difficult to try and dig a slit trench on a mountain where it's all rocks and everything. So what you used to sort of build an escarpment out of rocks that were around you. There is one thing though that we were building. It was when we returned to the Gloucesters and to Gloucester Hill. We obviously couldn't use the slip trenches that they'd used because they'd become graves. So we had to make a new defence line. And we were quietly digging away one day and we thought, oh, blow, we're not going to go any deeper. There was three of us at the time because we had a Bren and we also shared the mortar as well, 2-inch mortar. And we were opened up on, and you'd be surprised what two men, one bloke digging and two laying over the top, how many rocks that you can shift. So anyway, we did finish up with quite a good slit trench after that. But, yes, it is basically your defences were built up, and of course, as soon as they opened up with mortars, they collapsed. It wasn't till the latter part of the war when the war became static, and I can't experience a bit because I was home by then, but on Hook and various other things, they had really dug in. They had trenches and they had themselves really organised. But it was all open warfare, moving all the time.
How did that corporal come to be captured?
I don't know, because this was at the time when we split. Because even though we tried to stay together as a group, because a group of men together can help each other, watch each other's backs. But after that, we all became sort of split up and disorganised and everything. And the corporal went off with a couple of lads up the mountains, up the edge of the hill, the opposite side. And a couple of us came out on the tank. And after that... actually, there was three of us on the tank, but one fell off. We don't know what happened to him. And the others, obviously, they didn't get up the hill fast enough. And they were overrun. I never saw the air corporal since then. And it was a few years ago that I learned that he died back in Ireland. So,
what was your opinion of the Chinese enemy?
A very they only had one thought in life, and that was to kill us. We never actually got personal contact with them to that extent, you see, when you capture a Chinese man, and then a lot of the lads found it beneficial. Most of them, they had a belt of food around their back, like the belly bag of today. It was a canvas strap with pockets in, and they had, because they could go all day on a handful of rice, you see. And all the others was contained drugs of some sort or another, so they were not, should we say, really in this world. They were all sort of hallucinating and everything. So we, they were, people that didn't really know what they were doing, and they were so brainwashed that the capitalists, we're all classed as Americans, and they were taught to hate Americans. Americans were to be destroyed. That is one thing that apparently what I've heard from returned prisoners, that when they found that you were British, you, in a way, you were treated a little better than what the Americans were. And anyway, I think the Britons have got more stickability than any other nation. We are a nation of, if we can pull through, we'll pull through. And that's what's happening out in Korea. We stuck by each other and helped each other through, and I suppose it's called comradeship, and that's the reason why there are veterans associations today, to keep this comradeship and helpfulness and group therapy, shall we say, going.
What's happened to you after the Imjin battle?
We were sent back to be re-equipped. More men were sent up. We were re-equipped with all the necessary tools of war. And then we were sent back in to, after several sort of patrols to find out where the Chinese were, we actually went back on to, as I say, Gloucester Hill, and tried to sort that out and clear that out and find out who was still there and what was still there, and try and reclaim the bodies of those that had died there. And then sort of from there, we had, once that was all tidied up, it was basically they sat there then on and sorted out until the 38th parallel was set up as the peace line, because once the peace starts talking, we obviously, the war went static, and I don't know a great deal of that, you see, because I was only in Korea from the 7th of January, I say only, 9 months was long enough, until a time in September when I came home.
And were you in any other fighting after the Imjin?
Only minor skirmishes, only battle patrol skirmishes. That was basically all long range stuff. But as I say, being a non-smoker, I was sort of one of these people that had to go out, sit on a hill with an OP, and once we found them, and help range the guns onto the opposing forces. But
did you have much to do with the Allied troops, like the Americans and other nations?
We saw very little of them. That was one of the problems, you see, of that war. There was such a wide front, and there wasn't really, well, there wasn't enough ground forces to cover the area a lot. The only time I saw the Americans, the Americans was, we had no transport of our own. We'd lost all air transport. Either fallen to pieces or got blown up anyway. We relied on the Americans' transport division. The Negro driver, or the coloured drivers of the American forces, they had a wonderful transport section with their Dodges and that, and their GMCs, General Motor Vehicles, wonderful trucks they were. And that was the only actual Americans that we had personal contact, where, as far as I was concerned, had personal contact with. I saw a few Australians when I went on leave to Korea for supposedly rest and recuperation. It was called R&R, rest and recuperation. It was more like wreck and ruin, actually, but because it was really 4 days of an orgy, but that's a part of a soldier's life. But apart from that, I never saw a few. We were relieved by some Puerto Ricans at one time when we were on one of our little skirmishes, and we were on came through and relieved us, and we went back into reserve for a little while, but actual personal contact, no. We never really had a lot of personal contact, even with our own regiment. I mean, I was in a section of perhaps five or six men and we had a knoll, a hill, a ridge to look after, to protect, and you probably wouldn't see the rest of the company for a week till you went up and back to the company and got more. We were so, you see, that's the reason why the Chinese had the advantage of us. They could go through us without us even knowing that they'd gone through. We were so thinly spread. But there you go. That was it.
Your rest and recreation was in Japan?
Yeah, back in Kure in Japan.
So what did you do during those few days?
Get drunk. That's about all, really. No, to tell the truth, we used to go out at night and have a pint or two, but being that sort of a person, while I was in the country, I thought, well, I'm never going to get a chance of coming back again. And so I spent quite a lot of time actually going around seeing what the country was, you know, the around the temples and all the places in Japan there. In other words, I was sort of treating myself as a tourist, really, and had a look at Japan and see what it was like. Not only the front streets, but the back streets. In the hotel where we was, what the army had taken over, that was an experience. After 6 months of living rough, to actually go back and sleep in a bed with sheets and you could take your clothes off at night was a wonderful experience. Because I went from the January to the April without even having to wash and shave or change of clothes. For a start, it was too cold, and for another thing, we never had a change of clothes. But
did that mean you became verminous?
Yes. Very sorry to say, but we became lousy. Not very pleasant, but we were all in the same situation. You know, thinking back, we must have stunk to high heaven. And yet, I suppose, even in the very cold, I mean, used to get 40 below, nothing, you know. You used to sweat like the day and get soaking wet, and at night time your clothes froze to you because it was so cold. It was a wonderful country. Summertime was brilliant though. I mean, after the Battle of the Imjin, we went on a company patrol, battle patrol, to find out where the Chinese were. And it was lovely. We were going up through this valley and over these hills. And there's no sort of real big trees in Korea because they can't grow. They get blown over. But it was all sort of like small fir scrub and azaleas. Hills were covered in azaleas, purple azaleas. And they were just coming out into flower. Being a countryman, I really loved that. That was great going up through that. And in the springtime, it was a really lovely country. Well, no wonder the Japanese used to treat it as a game reserve. I mean, I would imagine it was very much like the mountains of up in Scotland or like that. It was that was covered in heather, but you could, you know, see the purple on the hills for miles and miles and miles. It was wonderful. If it wasn't for the atrocities out there, Korea as a country and the people of Korea, the Koreans themselves, the South Koreans were wonderful people. I don't know why it should be, but the North Korean, he was a vicious person, a very, perhaps they were too indoctrinated with the communist regime or something. But you could tell a North Korean, when we met a few of them, well, not met them, but came in contact with them as prisoners, and the South Koreans, different altogether they were. The South Korean is a much more sociable person, you know, and yet it's only a tiny country, and yet there's the North and South. We got on with the South Koreans very well. Maybe it's because we were helping to defend their country that they were But even the peasant in the country who couldn't really care less whether there was a war on it, whether they were, you know, as long as they were allowed to go on and do their farming, they were quite a happy people. But we got to know some of the families out there quite well, because most of the units took over orphan children. We weren't, I'm getting more onto the human side of life again, we weren't supposed to even give them sweets or chocolate or anything, but we did. And most units had one or two orphans with them. And we used to clothe them and feed them. And of course, they used to know their way around. If you went into a Korean village, they knew where the food store was. Here we are, back on the food again, but they knew where the rice was kept and everything. And they led us straight to the headman's house and the pots of rice at the back, and we'd have a good old cook up of rice, and went down very well. We all had to. And what happened to these lads? Well, we used to do, they used to get passed from one detachment to the other when we came home. They were all called Kim, by the way. whatever their name was, they were all Kims. But that was the more the social side of it. But the South Koreans, yes. Nice people. Simple people. All they're happy with, as long as they've got their farm and their work. They're quite content. It's not until you get to the modern Korea of today where everything's come in. Industrialization, though they had it to a certain extent out there, but I'm afraid they didn't have much of it when we left, because we'd knocked most of it down.
Did you ever get wounded or fall sick in Korea?
I had malaria out there. I had a batch of malaria, but that was sort of, unless you really had it bad, that was treated as a cold. You sort of just shrugged it off and stayed in your blankets for a little while and sweated it out. And see, we're so short of people that even the half sick were basically kept on duty. And I got a few grenades, bits in my face at one time, and a couple of bits in my arm when we were coming out of Imjin. But
how did that happen?
Oh, just a grenade went off on the side of the tank and the splinters came over the top.
Did they heal up all right?
Yeah. Just got cleaned up, patch put on them, and then gradually after the years they've just worked their way out. Little bits come out, and for years afterwards little bits of shrapnel used to come out, not very big bits, but they worked their way out.
What do you feel like now about having served in the Korean War?
It was an experience that, yes, now I'm home, it was something that you can't say you wouldn't have missed, because there is the war side of it, but to have toured halfway around the world and seen how other people live, the other side of the coin of life. Yes, I've no regrets to that extent. I can't. It's a sort of thing that, shall we say, that if you knew you were going to survive, you could probably have enjoyed it better. But with the fear all the time that, are you going to see the next day? It doesn't actually prey on your mind, but it sits in the back of your mind. It's the way that one approaches life. But now I look back at it as an experience, and something that taught me to appreciate the good things of life, to appreciate what you've got, and be thankful that we survived. And
when they extended the national service to 2 years, did you feel indignant about it?
Yes. Very indignant, because I mean, we weren't volunteers, we were conscripted, and that was the bugbear all the time, that you had to do something that you didn't really want to do. And when they extended, because we were hoping, yes, we'll pop off to Hong Kong, have a look around Hong Kong, and, you know, have a jolly good time at the government's expense, because up till then, apart from, I mean, missing a bit of home life, but at least it taught you to wake up, become a man, defend for yourself, look after yourself, know what it's all about. I think it was a good thing. It taught us self-control, independence, and respect. I think it taught you how to respect one another's way of life, respect each other, respect. I think that's what I've no objection to it now. It was an inconvenience at the time, but looking back on it, it's an experience that yes, generally it was enjoyed.
How did the Ulstermen accept Englishmen in the unit?
It all depends how much tape you've got left. Yes, they accepted us to a certain extent. You usually found that the man from Northern Ireland accepted you, but the Southern Islander, it was a not animosity, but there was always a feeling. There was always if they could drop us into it, they would. Let's put it that way. But the, as I say, most of the lads that we were from Northern Ireland anyway. It's the extent to, if we've got time, would tell you a small little incident that happened on St Patrick's Day.
Go on, tell me. You can always go on to the other side.